Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So this evening I'll just say a few words. Words for us to reflect and contemplate. And contemplating the theme of death and dying. This is actually something that until quite recently in Western society we never really talked about. It was almost something a little bit shocking to even mention these words. Yeah. Our society was very much one of denial. Finding any way that we possibly could to avoid thinking about, speaking about, acknowledging the fact of our mortality. And this was something that I think was a sign that society had moved away from nature, had moved very far away. And I think it probably resulted in a lot of loneliness, a lot of confusion in the hearts of people, particularly people when they were terminally ill, dying. The inability of people to acknowledge what was happening. Certainly this discomfort continues to be pretty widespread in the society, and there's not many circles where we can talk comfortably about these matters. But I must say for myself, with a tremendous sense of relief, that we can, that there is the encouragement now to bring this topic out into the open. Because it's something that's obviously of direct relevance to each one of us. And it's something that probably we'll never properly understand, we'll never completely be able to understand. Because it's a very mysterious. Our human existence is actually very mysterious. But at least we can begin to approach it, at least we can begin to make friends with it, begin to familiarize ourselves with it. We don't have to shut it away, shut it out, pretend it doesn't exist. I think when one has an experience of somebody that one knows dying, there's a sense of it's a bit of a mind-blowing thing. You know, what's happened? Where have they gone? The mind can't quite grasp what's happened. Even when one has the opportunity to see the body, to sit with the body, there's still a sense of what's happened, where have they gone? I remember the first time I had a chance to look at someone who'd died, somebody that I'd known very well, an old lady that I'd looked after and been very friendly with. She was one of my closest friends, and she died when she was about almost 90. And I remember knowing that we were going to be going to look at the body and almost not wanting to. This feeling of strangeness. Like when you meet somebody for the first time, it's a slight feeling of shyness, of awkwardness. We went to this place where she was in a coffin, and I don't know if it was pink or white frills kind of all around, and made up. It was very strange. And her hands. And just looking at this little corpse, it was actually all right. It didn't look like the person that I'd known. It wasn't like there's Nanda. It was just something quite strange. And I noticed the feeling of not actually wanting to touch it, the feeling of wanting to draw back. It's almost like an animal instinct, just not wanting to get too close, and actually having to make myself touch the hands, the cold hands. It's quite a powerful thing. Just to contemplate that, how far removed we've become from this very simple and obvious fact of our human existence. And many adults I know who still, into adult life, have never had a chance to look at a dead body. When I was a few weeks ago, in recent months, a couple of people who've been close friends of the community have died, and I was very interested to, if it was at all possible to be with them at the moment of death, because it was something I'd never experienced before. And I asked Ajahn Sucitto, who's the abbot at Chithurst, mentioned my interest, and he has a peculiar kind of humour, and he said, well, so what about your own body? Isn't that dying? And it wasn't quite as dismissive as one might have imagined, and I could easily have been very offended, very upset, but it actually caused me to think, yes, this is perhaps the body that one should be contemplating. This is the dying that one should be contemplating. As it happened, there wasn't the chance to be with either of these women as they were dying, but I certainly had a chance to have quite a lot of contact with them in the weeks, the hours before they died. And that was very very fruitful, very rich experience. But how much at ease, how much have we made friends with the fact of our own mortality? Can we really begin to grasp the fact that these bodies here will also, within the next 20, 30, 40 years, maybe 50 if we're lucky, or unlucky, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse to live into one's 80s, 90s, 100s, I don't know, but certainly within, by the, I don't know, the year 2050, say, most of us won't be here anymore. Have we really contemplated that? I find it's quite a strong medicine, in fact, just noticing the physical changes in my own body. Remember, quite a number of years ago, I started getting lines on my face, and with my mother looking closely at my face, there's a kind of frown line down the middle here. And she was obviously very disturbed by this. And sort of tried to encourage me to avoid frowning because she didn't like to see this line appearing. And one realizes that this is part of what we can, part of life, is that at a certain time the appearance changes. In fact, the appearance is changing all the time in subtle ways, but one gradually begins to see lines coming on the face. I find it's very one of the things that I find very interesting is like meeting people who I haven't seen, say, for 15 or 20 years, and one notices changes in their appearance, and one realizes that, you know, that I also have changed, that my appearance has changed. Noticing the way that the energy in the body changes. Faculties, not able to see or maybe hear quite so well. Beginning to forget things. And this is also part of the aging process. And one can recognize a kind of not feeling quite comfortable with this. But having come across this teaching, having the opportunity to pick up this teaching that the Buddha presented to us, we have a chance to begin to stop avoiding this slight uncomfortableness of our human existence, the fact of aging. Changes in the body. One notices how this is not something that society feels very comfortable with. You look in the media, magazines, and so on. That they're absolutely full of products and cures. Vitamin E seems to be the big thing to keep you young. various tonics and cures to maintain the vigor and the health of the body. Not that there's anything wrong with taking proper care of the body, looking after it in, out of a sense of compassion, a sense of kindness, but recognizing if our care, our concern, is a fear or an aversion, an unwillingness to accept the fact that we're getting old. These bodies have the nature to age. We've not gone beyond aging. So the body is one thing that we have a very strong tendency to attach to identify with. If we think we're the body, then we'll die when the body dies. We have a chance to begin to question, to challenge our identity with the human body. To contemplate birth. This is a pretty strange happening, a strange event that each one of us has been through. I doubt that any of us remember it, but we've certainly all experienced it. This body has been born. And from the moment of birth, it has been alive and it's been changing. There's various processes, systems that work to maintain the vitality, the energy. The life of the body, the energy of the body, and then at some stage, the death of the body. So we can contemplate attachment to our own bodies. We can begin to investigate this attachment. We can begin to study our bodies in a more dispassionate, a cooler way, to experience it as being to be part of nature. Part of the mystery of life. Quite an extraordinary organism. And we can also begin to examine our attachment to others, friends, relations, family. And to contemplate their mortality also. I think perhaps in some ways our own death and dying is easier to contemplate than that of those that we love. Because if we really recognize the fact that we're going to die, or perhaps we've been told that we have some illness that is going to cause our death within a certain length of time, we're very much in touch with that. We can't really, there's no real getting away from it. We have to acknowledge it, we have to face up to it. But perhaps with those that we love, it's more difficult. A sense of helplessness. A sense of anger. All kinds of confusing emotions can arise. Remember one time I thought that my mother was very seriously ill, and I remember feeling really just wishing it could be anybody else's mother. You know, why does it have to be my mother? Couldn't somebody else's mother be seriously ill, dying? Very, very awful thing to think, to wish on anybody that their mother be ill and dying. But the mind does that. I'm sure each one of you who's been in a similar situation or bereaved in one way or another will have experienced all kinds of irrational, apparently inappropriate emotions. The struggle of the mind to make sense of what's happening, to come to terms with it. This morning I was talking about Kisa Gotami and the totally irrational way that she tried to get the Buddha to cure her child who died. Just like being driven mad by the sorrow, the inability to come to terms with what had happened. I was talking to somebody this morning who was pointing out that this can also happen not in relation to somebody's death, but maybe a dramatic change in our lifestyle. Perhaps the collapse of a relationship, or losing a job, or some kind of serious illness or accident that changes our capacity for doing certain things. But any one of these things can also bring about a kind of grieving. A very powerful feeling of loss, feeling of sadness. Feeling of almost as though part of oneself has been torn away. We all of us know that we shouldn't attach, that if we were fully enlightened we would have no attachment, but since we're not yet fully enlightened we do have attachment. And when things change there's sorrow. So how do we deal with this? How do we deal with these feelings? How do we carry on with our lives when we're experiencing the grieving, tremendous sadness, sorrow? We have to be able to really acknowledge how we are, what's happening with us. And I think in Western society we're very powerful conditioning is this sort of stiff upper lip. Yeah. Pick yourself up, carry on, as if nothing had happened. I'm all right, everything's fine. Sometimes there can be a tremendous sense of denial. Everything's fine, everything's all right. Don't worry about me. When the pain is very bad, this is our way of coping. Because somehow our society says that it's not all right for us to be sad. it's not all right for things to be all wrong. It's somehow a sense of failure if we break down, if we give in. But in order for healing to occur, in order to heal, we have to admit that there's a sense of sadness, a sense of loss, that there is some sense of dis-ease. We have to be able to acknowledge that. We have to be able to acknowledge that we're falling apart, that it is all wrong. There's certainly a time and a place for this. I remember one time on a retreat there was somebody who was shortly going to be joining the community, and she was actually married and was very committed to becoming part of the monastic community, and had had permission from her husband, and was all set to come, but obviously the impending separation was a source of tremendous anguish to her. And on this meditation retreat, and every sitting there was this kind of terrible kind of weeping that would start. Time after time after time, and you know, we all sat with it and were kind of compassionate and aware of her, of the pain. But one realized that in fact perhaps it wasn't appropriate to have this thing repeating itself. That it was actually quite disturbing for the other people, and that sometime later on, Ajahn Sumedho gave a talk about the need for, you know, restraint at certain times. That there are times when it's appropriate to express emotion. There are other times when it's good to try to practice restraint. Obviously, sometimes you can't. It just all comes piling out, and so that's this is what happens. But to see that there is a time and a place. Not everybody is able to receive our sadness, our grieving. I think perhaps there's a tremendous fear that these kind of emotions bring up in people, because it reminds them of their own vulnerability. Something that people will do anything they can to avoid. But among people who practice, one begins to have a sense that of support, of friendship. There's a place that you can come and you can be sad. It's all right. Ajahn Chah used to encourage people to always see something as broken, like if you're given a new cup, to see it as broken. As a way of detaching, avoiding getting entranced by whatever it is. If we attach to something new and attractive and beautiful, we get to really like it, then when it is broken, there'll be sadness. Whereas if we acknowledge its mortality right from the start, acknowledge that its impermanence, then when it breaks, it's no big deal. This is how it is. Of course, this is one thing on the level of cups and trinkets, possessions of one kind or another. But it moves on to a different scale when we're talking about bodies, our own bodies or the bodies of those others around us. It's quite touching in reading the account of the Buddha's passing away. And at the time of his death, his disciples were all gathered around, and it says that those were the ones who were not yet fully enlightened, experienced, they kind of wailed and they rolled around on the ground and they said, "Oh, our teacher is dying, our teacher is going." And experienced tremendous grieving and sadness. Whereas the enlightened ones were able to just sit and to say that, you know, what arises ceases. The ones that who were no longer identified with the body, they were able to see that this is just the death of the body, something that's part of nature. So they didn't experience the same anguish because they knew that everything in nature has the nature, you know, it's has the quality of arising and ceasing. It's unstable. Insubstantial. If any of you have ever had a chance to be at a Buddhist funeral, now one of the things I found most striking attending Buddhist funerals is that they're very calm, very calming. There's a very simple acknowledgement, a reminder of what's happened. The funeral chanting is a recitation of all of the different kinds of conditions that as a human being we can experience. You know, the skillful, the unskillful, the happy, the unhappy, the whole long list of different dhammas. And just we just kind of repeat it. It's a very soothing chant that we do, and it's chanted for the benefit of the people present, and also we chant it for the benefit of the one who's died, you know, wherever they might be, just as a reminder to just keep letting go of all of these conditions. They're all changing, impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self, not to be clung to, not to be identified with or attached to. And another chant that we always do is Anicca Vada Sankara. It's in the nature of all conditions to be impermanent, unstable. Having arisen, they pass away. Having been born, they die. And their passing, their stilling, brings peace. Pointing to what is most obvious, but which can actually bring a tremendous sense of calm, rather than feeling that something has gone terribly wrong. Just saying, this is how it is, this is what we can expect. Naturally, as unenlightened human beings, there'll be a feeling of sadness. And this is all right too. I've noticed that when Sister Nanda died and when Sister Upala died, in fact, a whole mixture of feelings. Partly there was tremendous sadness, partly there was a kind of feeling of just being very touched by the beauty of their lives. There's a lot of weeping happens at the time of someone's death, and it's not all sadness. And sometimes it's just a feeling of being really touched at the beauty and the mystery of life and death. Also, we can bring up a sense of gratitude rather than feeling angry or bitter that they're no longer with us, which are perfectly natural things. Like, you know, I know that, you know, when these emotions can come up, you know, how dare you die kind of thing. I mean, I don't know if you'd actually say it in so many words, but one can have a sense of anger that someone has died, someone has left us. We can experience it almost as a rejection. But we can replace that perhaps with a sense of gratitude that we had the opportunity to know this person, to be a part of their life, that they had, and to really contemplate the what they've given us. When the Buddha was dying, there was a lot of talk about how he should be venerated. You know, I think his disciples even asked him, you know, what would be the appropriate way to venerate you after you've died? And there were various things that were said, the ways that the body should be treated and so on. But he said, if you really want to venerate me, if you really want to show your respect and appreciation, what you should do is, and the highest form of veneration is to practice what I've taught. And perhaps we can bring this reflection into that consideration of people that we've known and loved. You know, how can we really honour them? One can, you know, have some kind of special place where the ashes are scattered or where they're buried. You can take care of that, take care of the grave, these kind of things. But perhaps the best thing, the thing that would make them happiest, that they would feel, you know, if they knew, that they would feel most pleased about, would be to try to follow their example. If they have, you know, some good qualities, things that we appreciate about them, to think, well, this person is very kind, very generous. Maybe I can try to be like that. Or like my godmother died, and she was somebody who was a kind of quality of unconditional acceptance. That's the first time I'd experienced that from another human being. And so I can think of my godmother and think, well, maybe I can try to bring that quality into my own life. This is a kind of more wholesome, more positive way of thinking of people after they've died, rather than, you know, how could you leave me? Or what am I going to do without you? To think, well, how can I honour, how can I show my appreciation for what this human being has been for me? I'm always impressed at the Asian custom, and perhaps it'll become a British custom, I don't know. Like when a close friend or relative has died, what they do is they come to the monastery. They come and they prepare a big meal and they offer it to the community, and they share the meal themselves. So sometimes you have large groups of Sri Lankan people and they bring food for 50 or 100 people to the monastery. I was quite overwhelmed when I first saw this. Big pots of rice and all kinds of things. And they'd all get together and bring this. There'd always be a very kind of joyful feeling. Is it like saying, well, obviously you can't give your mother, your father, your husband, your wife anything. You can't do anything physically for them now because they no longer have a body. There's nothing you can't feed them, you can't give them something to drink, you can't make them comfortable. But what you can do is you can do something good and wholesome and share the blessing. This is a traditional custom I was talking about this morning, sharing the blessing of the goodness of one's life with those who have died. So rather than getting lost in poor me, how awful, I'm left all alone now, which is, as I said, a perfectly natural reaction. You think, well, what can I do now for this person? How can I help? And so the whole family will get together, and I don't know about all of you, but I mean, I used to just love kind of going shopping and buying food and cooking something delicious to share with friends. And so when one's feeling sad, often just to kind of get out there and do a bit of shopping, cook something up and offer it to somebody is quite a skillful way. Offering it in memory of the person who's died. You know. So when we have these occasions, sometimes people like to come and plant a tree in memory of somebody. Like at Chithurst, we've got masses and masses of trees that people have planted in memory of relatives. And there's a similar kind of quality, you know, planting something. Something living in memory of someone who's died, a way of remembering them in a wholesome way. So when we have these dhanas, and people come and offer food or tree plantings, there's a whole mixture of feelings, and often there's a lot of tears. There's a kind of tremendous feeling of sadness that arises, and this is natural. But there's also a feeling of joyfulness and gladness, of actually doing something, offering something for this person, expressing one's love, one's gratitude for this person, for their life, for the chance that one has had to know this person. When we're mindful, we can experience a whole range of emotions and begin to see that they're not, none of it is anything to be frightened of. Yeah. When there's mindfulness, there's no suffering. There might be sadness, there might be sorrow, there might be the feeling of one's heart being torn out or having lost an arm. There's this kind of incredible feeling of loss. But it's bearable, it's all right. And one can see how quickly it changes. The feelings of joyfulness, when we remember sort of happy times or good things or funny things about the person. It's often a time of softening in the heart. Many families, perhaps, who haven't really been together or had much contact with one another for years, are often brought together at the time of a death, when people come together and can often be a time of great healing within a family situation. So when we practice mindfulness, we try to live more closely with Dhamma, with nature. We make a space in our lives for a lot more things to happen, rather than trying to keep it fixed and under control. To keep it the way we want it, we relinquish that control. And suddenly life takes on a whole other dimension. I seem to have said a lot of things today, and there's obviously many more things that can be said on this particular topic, but perhaps I've said enough for today. I offer these thoughts for your reflection, contemplation. And those of you who'd like to have a stretch, or take a breath of air, and we can then have a short sitting to end the evening. So we can notice how things are for us in this moment, right now. The beginning of the day. It's dark now. In a short while it will be light. Gathering together to recollect, bringing to mind our highest aspiration, our potential. Our potential to realize truth. Reflecting on the Buddha, that which knows, which sees clearly. which understands things as they are. Reflecting on the truth, the Dhamma, that which can be experienced here and now, wherever we are, whatever we're doing. We don't have to set up any special conditions. It's not something that just exists inside this shrine room, this retreat center. It's something that is with us wherever we are, whatever the moment. There is the Dhamma, there is the truth that we can know, that we can realize, experience directly. We recollect the Sangha. That within us which aspires towards living in accordance with this truth. It aspires towards mindfulness, towards turning away from selfishness, from ego-centered wanting. Recognizing desire, recognizing wanting, but not believing in it. It aspires towards living in a way that is in harmony with nature, in harmony with other beings, rather than in a way that is always setting ourselves at odds, conflicting, disagreeing. I'm right, you're wrong. When we open to Dhamma, we recognize that truth is universal. There are different points of view. And the heart is very grand, we can encompass every point of view. That's how it is. These five subjects of frequent recollection. Simple teaching that the Buddha presented. Once again, pointing to what is most obvious. But what we can often choose to ignore. We're frightened, we're fearful. We don't want to acknowledge these simple realities of our existence. But strangely enough, as long as we refuse to acknowledge them, we're in a sense bound by them. There's a holding, a manipulating. There's certain things we have to shut out of our consciousness. We can't let in. It's a paradox. Because when we can face up to them, acknowledge them, open to them, with a freedom. Everything is all right. There's a sense of ease with life, with our mortality, with death. Recently, I had the opportunity to visit someone who was close to death. And she'd known that she was likely to die fairly soon for some months. And she was talking about it, saying how at first she felt a tremendous amount of fear and tremendous sadness, tremendous grief at the thought of leaving her children, being separated from her children. But then I remembered the Buddha's teaching, I remembered the chanting, you know, this separation from what you love, this dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are dukkha. Because just opening to that reality, opening to that truth, took away the pain, took away the fear, took away the sadness. But this is what we have to expect in our human existence. That all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. It's no longer the fear, the holding. We accept it fully, we recognize it fully. We realize we can't hold it, we can't keep it. But we can enjoy it. We can delight in it. We can allow it to change. We did some chanting. You were with this friend, did the morning chanting that we've just done together now. We said goodbye. We spoke with her family. I said to them, I said, she's doing really well. And they looked a bit surprised because for them what they saw was somebody dying. They saw a body dying. And for them this was not a sign that someone was doing really well. But of course what I was talking about was that this person was at ease, was totally at ease with what was happening, had come to terms with the inevitable death of the body, with the inevitable separation from what he loved. A sense that things were as good as they could possibly be for this person in this moment. There was no way that one could stop the body from dying. that this sense of ease one realized was perhaps the most precious thing that we can experience in our human existence. Quite frequently in the monastery we have groups of school children come to visit young people just beginning their lives, and it's interesting talking to them. One of the things that I encourage them to contemplate is, you know, what is the most precious thing in our lives as human beings? For many of them, they've been brought up with a rather worldly attitude, to make a lot of money, to be successful, to find the perfect partner, the perfect companion, to have a family, be successful, all these things, to be attractive, beautiful, strong, healthy. And while, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with any of these things, what one always points out is the fact that perhaps that the most precious thing is a sense of ease, peace of mind, a feeling of being at ease with oneself, at ease with one another. That everything else will change. We can't hold on to it. But when we fully acknowledge that, we find the refuge. We find that place of non-attachment, of peace, calm. This sense of inner ease allows us to move through life easily. We don't hold on to the past, we're not yearning for the future. We're at ease with this moment. One realizes that sickness and death can come at any time. Not so long ago I had a birthday, and sometimes in the monastery on one's birthday people make quite a fuss of you. You bake a cake, you make something special at breakfast time, give you presents. And on this particular birthday, I arrived at breakfast time with a plate of very fancy biscuits and suddenly realized I wasn't hungry. It's very unusual for me not to be hungry. Especially when there are delicious biscuits and at breakfast time. I wasn't hungry, I felt sick. And not wanting to spoil the party, I ate a couple of biscuits and thought, well, maybe this will pass. And came to the meal time, they made a special cake. And this time I realized I was really sick. I didn't even want to go and look at the cake. And I thought, this shouldn't happen. It's my birthday. It shouldn't happen. It shouldn't be like this. You know, I should be able to play the part of, you know, the birthday girl, join in the celebration, have a good time. And there I was, just a crumpled heap in the nun's room, just feeling dreadful, sore head, feeling sick, not interested in eating or having a good time. And this was actually a very special gift, a very special teaching on my birthday. Because it reminded me that sickness is not something that is convenient. It doesn't come when it's convenient. And similarly with death. It doesn't come when we've neatly tied up all our affairs, when we're ready, when the house is clean and tidy, and we're ready to go. But usually it doesn't. I mean, sometimes people can arrange it like that, but usually it's something that just happens when it's the time for it to happen. Not necessarily our time for it to happen. Bearing this in mind, we have to learn how to live our lives so that we're ready. Even if it's not the most convenient time, if things are not exactly the way we would want them to be, with mindfulness, there is a sense of ease. I was noticing this morning during the chanting, I really don't like overhead lights. I'm really a very strong aversion to harsh overhead lighting. The overhead lights were on. And I had cramp in my foot. Definitely not convenient. Wasn't how things should have been. I should have had calm, soft lighting, and my body should have felt all right. But it wasn't like that. There was physical discomfort. There was unpleasant sensory impingement. So there was a need to let go of one's preferences, of one's desires, to find a sense of ease, even when things weren't particularly comfortable, weren't particularly pleasant, according to how I would have chosen. The very very simple example, very ordinary, but we can learn from the most ordinary, the most simple, unspectacular things of life. Keeping our eyes and ears open for the lessons that life has to teach us. As I said yesterday, developing our practice of mindfulness, cultivating presence of mind, is in itself the best possible preparation for death. of being fully present, fully sensitive to our own dukkha, our own difficulty, our own yearning, longing, we naturally attune to the suffering of others. We become more sensitive. We live in a way that is naturally more in harmony with others. We don't create a lot of ripples, a lot of difficulty for each other. When we sit quietly, with a sense of ease, we can feel a deep sense of dignity, of self-respect. At least we've made the effort to live carefully, made the effort to make good use of this lifetime, to learn the lessons that life has had to teach us. We haven't wasted it. And this is a great blessing. One of the things I found coming into my mind this morning was a line from a Christian hymn. I can't remember what the hymn is, but the phrase, "Live this day as if 'twere thy last." And this is perhaps something that we should have as a contemplation, that this day could be our last. Can we live it mindfully? Can we make the best possible use of this time? Can we avoid doing things that are going to cause harm? It will bring a sense of regret. If we do make a mistake, can we forgive ourselves? Cultivating this attitude of forgiveness, of kindliness, both towards ourselves and towards one another. Beginning again. Living each moment with a sense of freshness, of openness, of interest. Even the unpleasant can be interesting. We can bear it. Realizing this, there's a sense of lightness and joy that comes into our existence, an ability to laugh, to live fully, wholeheartedly, not holding back, living without fear, without regret. We can sit quietly together for a short while.